So David is going to be speaking on an intriguing topic, the Book of Revelation, the blueprint for the New World Order. And there was a reference by Tony about Ab Cowell. So over to you, David. You've got 30 minutes.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. So I'm glad that Tony gave a bit of a segue into this discussion. A little bit about myself. I converted to Islam about 30 years ago. It was part of a search for the truth, also a spiritual search. That search led me to try to understand the world we're living in. And I began my search in history, which has resulted now in 5 books. The latest book is a 6-volume work, which is called Ordo Ab Cowell. It's very much not only basically a consolidation of my previous work and a significant expansion on what I've done. So mainly what I have traced is the history of the occult. The world we live in now, we live in a world where after centuries of operating underground, the first successes of the occult secret societies were two revolutions, and that's the American and French revolutions. When, you know, after being basically being persecuted and forced underground for centuries, they finally managed to achieve some degree of political power. And they've been expanding that power ever since. So what is rarely understood is that, it took me a long time to recognize it, is that there is a blueprint, there is a plan to follow. And that plan, one of them, a very significant one, is the Book of Revelation. So I'm going to start by reading Albert Pike, because he was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. This is a very important tradition within Freemasonry, which I trace in my latest book as well, too. Founded in Charleston in 1801, I believe. And very much was a consolidation of the Masonic forces that were developing until that time. So what this paragraph here is particularly important, because what he is speaking, what he covers here in two paragraphs, is what took me years to uncover, and what mainstream historians are still missing. So basically he says, the occult science of the ancient Magi was concealed under the shadows of the ancient mysteries. It was imperfectly revealed, or rather disguised by the Gnostics. It is guessed at under the obscurities that cover the pretended crimes of the Templars, and is found enveloped in enigmas that seem impenetrable to the rites of the highest masonry. So basically this is the core. It was this scientific religious absolute, he says, basically talking about the lost word, which was the underlying ideology that led to the Templars, the Rosicrucians, and finally the Illuminati and the Freemasons. So why that's important is basically, so first of all, to do a quick recap, this is founded on effectively the history of the Old Testament. And as you all know, basically the Judaism begins with Abraham. His grandson, Jacob, also known as Israel, had 12 sons. Those sons, their sons had moved to Egypt. Their ancestors were eventually brought out of Egypt by Moses, and they settled in Palestine. And there they were expected to conquer the known inhabitants, who are known as Canaanites. Canaanites practiced the cult of Baal, which is a dying god cult of a dying and resurrecting god. So what happens is that they remained there for centuries, but because they were warned repeatedly to avoid the worship of Baal. But they went against these commands. First of all, what happens is that at a certain point, Solomon, who's the son of King David, builds the Temple of Solomon. So famous in Jewish and biblical history. And this was supposed to be a magnificent temple, also houses the Ark of the Covenant and so on and so forth. So, but what happens is that as the the Israelites pollute their cult, the temple itself becomes basically replaced. It's no longer a temple to the one God, but it becomes a pagan temple dedicated to the various Baal and his sister spouse Astarte. So because of these crimes, basically the Jews are warned repeatedly if they persist, that they're going to be taken away into captivity. So the first thing that happens is that actually at a certain point, the kingdom of Israel becomes divided in two. So there's the kingdom of the north, which is comprised of the 10 tribes, and then the southern kingdom of Judah, which is comprised of Judah and Benjamin. So the Assyrians come in the early 700s BC and conquer the northern kingdom and disperse the 10 tribes. This is the first of the warnings. The second warning comes about in 597, I believe, BC, when the Babylonians conquer southern kingdom of Judah and take the people, the entire population of Judah, to captivity in Babylon. So this is a time when this is a very important pivotal period. In fact, it's referred to as the Axial Age. And what happens is that during this time, while the Jews are in captivity, they compose probably about 30% of the population. This is the 50-year period when the Kabbalah is developed. What happens is, because the Jews are not known outside, basically the Jews are not really basically recognized by much of the rest of the world. After they develop this...
David, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, the people are saying that the slides need to be removed. Sorry for interrupting. Can you go through the slides?
Why? How? I'm speaking to the slide for now. I haven't changed my slide yet.
Okay, all right, fine. Okay.
Sorry, slides are coming.
It's not.
This is just background imagery for now.
Right, okay.
Okay. So, what happens is that these Jewish Kabbalists basically, in fact, this is described in the Quran. I got this clue from David Pidcock, which has been very important for my research in his book, Satanic Voices. So basically what happens is, this is referred to in the Quran as the angels, Harut and Marut, revealed magic to the devils who teach it to mankind, and they attribute it to Solomon. So supposedly what happens is that the Solomon had a number of jinn demons in his employ, and they hid a book of magic under his throne, so that when he died, it was rediscovered, and then that magic was attributed to him. This is very much, maybe not that legend specifically, but this idea of Solomon as a magical king and his temple as being somehow representative of his magical power is what endures through the occult tradition. So they are known to the rest. So basically they mix the Quran says that a segment of the Jews apostatize and practice this magic attributed to Solomon, and they know that they are basically selling their souls to the devil, that they are giving up on their pretend, they're giving up on the afterlife, turning back on the afterlife. And they merge their cult with the worship of Baal and and Babylonian magic and astrology. They are known to the ancient world as Magi, and they're falsely assumed to be worshippers of Zoroastrianism, but the reality is that they are heretical Zoroastrians who practice a particular heretical brand of Zoroastrianism called Zurbanism. And when the Persians conquer Babylon, the Jews are released from captivity. They're allowed to return to Palestine, and that's where they build the second temple. And some of them, not all of them, return to Palestine. Some of them go to Egypt, and that's how you get the beginnings of Greek philosophy, particularly the philosophy of Pythagoras and Plato, which is influenced by Orphism and the cults of Dionysus, which was influenced by the Magi. The other trajectory where this emerges is in Egypt, known as Hermeticism. And it also influences Christianity as what's called Gnosticism. So the other track is the one within Judaism is within a cult called the Essenes, who are basically also inheritors of the Magi. So this is the Essenes is where now you get the occult tradition in Judaism, which is more recognized. And this is where you get the beginnings of what's called the earliest origins of Kabbalah, which is called Merkaba mysticism. So Merkaba mysticism is focused on the vision described by Ezekiel, which has a lot to do with his visions of the temple, but also his visions of God on the throne. So this is not God, the creator. This is the Ancient of Days, which is why he's bearded and old. This is also a remnant of Zurbanism and is Saturn. So what you see here is that Ezekiel sees a creature carrying the throne, and there's four creatures. Each of them have four heads, two sets of wings, the body of a man, and cloven feet. And they're standing on a wheel inside a wheel. So what that stands for is the four heads are the four sections of the zodiac. So the human head is Aquarius, the eagle is Scorpio, Leo is the lion, and the bull is Taurus. They're standing on the wheel inside a wheel is the two equators. So there's the celestial equator and the earthly equator. So of course, you know that the earth circles around the sun, but it also spins on itself, which creates the perception of two equators. So that's the astrological basis of Ezekiel's vision. And this is the purpose of Merkaba mysticism, is to attain that vision. So now you have a confluence of occult influences in the ancient world, particularly out of Alexandria. And you get this proliferation of ancient mysteries. And there's a number of them. And they basically are, the most important one of them is the one attributed to Mithras. So this is what I cover in the genealogies that I cover in my book. It's what I call the Mithraic bloodline. As you look at the families that were involved in the spread of this cult, they're primarily the Julio-Claudio dynasty of Roman emperors, the House of Commagene in Turkey, the House of Herod, and I think that's all three of them. So the House of Herod, as you know, is basically the family of Herod the Great, intermarried significantly with all these families. And their descendants, one of the most important descendants is Constantine the Great. And so Constantine, basically what he did when he created effectively Catholic Christianity at the Council of Nicaea, is he imposed a dying God version of Christianity that replaced the original Jewish Reform movement. So where that comes from, basically the cult that he followed was a cult of Sol Invictus, which is a version of Mithraism. So you can see here that Mithras worships Azurvan or Saturn. It's a figure pretty essentially identical to the vision of Ezekiel, with the head of a lion. In this case, there's only one head, the lion standing on a wheel inside a wheel. But what happens at this time is you have a proliferation of apocalyptic literature in Judaism, which is where this tradition comes from. And basically based on expectations of the end time, but more not expectations of the end time, primarily dealing with revelations imparted to mystics. So this is a pattern which is very popular at the time, and this is why you have St. John. So the Book of Revelation basically is a type of literature which is typical of the time, typical of this early occult tradition. And because what's important to remember is that John was an apostle. So when you look at the New Testament, it's founded effectively on four books which communicate the teachings of Jesus. There are additional books to that come from Paul. Paul, again, is not a direct disciple. He claims to have had a vision. He's also an agent of the house of Herod, which is why he preaches a brand of Christianity, which is at variance with the Reformed Judaism of Jesus. Now we have this revelation, which is given to John. It's not a revelation that's given to Jesus. It's a revelation given specifically to John. So this is why Albert Pike explains that, he says, the apocalypse, that sublime, catalytic, and prophetic summary of all the occult figures, divides its images into three septenaries. So this is important, that this happens to be the very same paragraph where Albert Pike reveals his cryptic allegiance to Lucifer. The apocalypse, to those who receive the 19th degree, the apotheosis of the sublime faith, which aspires to God alone and despises all pomps and works of Lucifer. Lucifer, the light bearer, strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of the morning. Why he's calling us out in the morning there is because typically Lucifer is identified with Venus, and that's where you're going back to the worship of the goddess. So basically what Albert Pike is explaining, the purpose of his book, Morals and Dogma, which is considered the Bible of Freemasonry, is to explain that the purpose of Freemasonry is to rebuild the temple. So as I mentioned, the temple was rebuilt when the Jews returned to Babylon, but it was then again destroyed with the conquest of the Romans in 70 AD. So the goal of Freemasonry, the goal of the occult, is to, and the expectations for the end times, is that a third temple is going to be constructed. So the goal of Freemasonry is to build, allegorically rebuild, the third temple, which is why they're called Freemasons. And because they're going to bring about the coming of the Messiah. And that is what they call the great work, the magnum opus. And it's all based on the book of Revelation, which is effectively their blueprint. So what's interesting is that the book of Revelation, you see, repeats the four beasts, and that's the four creatures referred to in Ezekiel. So I've only got 10 minutes left, so I'm not going to go into detail here, but I'm going to just show you the image to make that reference. So the thing is, the book of Revelation is the one part, I think it is the last book that was entered into the New Testament. It wasn't entered until the 4th century, or around 400 AD. And that was after a lot of controversy. Even when it was finally accepted, there were still many who opposed it. And one of the reasons why is that it was believed that it wasn't actually John who wrote it or received it, but a Gnostic named Corinthus. So this is a fact that Albert Pike himself accepts. He says, thus explained Albert Pike, Corinthus of Ephesus, with most of the Gnostics, Philo the Kabbalah, Zend of Esther, the Puranas, and all the Orient, deemed the distance and antipathy between the Supreme Being and the pituitary world too great. So this is what Albert Pike refers to, the Oriental tradition that's found in the Kabbalah, which basically traces back to the worship of Lucifer. So jumping ahead, you have several centuries later, the ongoing plan, as I mentioned, of Freemasonry is to rebuild the third temple. And this is why you have the Templars are sent to the Holy Land to reconquer it. This is an absurd mission. This is at the time the world is dominated by, at least the Middle East and North Africa is dominated by the Islamic world. But instead of confronting Islam head on, their one mission is to conquer Jerusalem itself. And it appears that what they do is that they conduct excavations of the temple, and they uncover a book called the Sefer HaBahir, which then revives the study of Kabbalah. The Bahir basically sets off the history of Kabbalah in modern times, and it leads to the emergence of the legends of the Holy Grail, the Knights of the Garter, and the Order of the Garter, which is basically the Templar tradition in England. And out of that, you get the Rosicrucians. So the Rosicrucians, what's more important there is that it emerges out of a marriage between Frederick the fifth of Palatinate in Germany, a Protestant prince, who is married to Elizabeth Stuart. Elizabeth Stuart is the daughter of King James. And what you get out of this marriage is you get the descendants of all the most important people involved in modern occult tradition. So you can't read the details of this chart, but I'll go over it quickly. Basically, here you have Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, who becomes the head of Scottish Rite Freemasonry and writes the Compens. So this chart, basically, here you see Frederick the Great. I explain who that is. Here you have the family of Hessen-Kessel. You have Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel, and that's the family where the Rothschilds basically begin their financial careers. Prince Charles is also not only a member of the Illuminati, he's also the founder, he's also Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren. I won't go into detail about what they are. Then basically he marries into the Danish family, and his great-grandson is Christian IV of Denmark, who's known as Grandfather of Europe. And it's that family that Queen Elizabeth comes from through her through intermarriage with the descendants of George the Third. Whoops. And here you have this is the family of the Dukes of Orléans. They are basically the founders of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and their descendant is Philippe Galité, who is the Illuminati and one of the instigators, leaders of the French Revolution. So this is the family that basically gives birth to the Rosicrucian movement. That the Rosicrucians are the ones who are involved in instigating the career of Sabbatais V, who declared himself Messiah in 1666. And it's this movement, the Sabbatian movement. So basically, the Sabbatian movement is a formulation of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria. And what's important about Isaac Luria is that what was new in his version of Kabbalah is that he prescribed that the end times is not something that you wait for; it's something that you have to actively create. So this is why they created the career of Sabbatais V, and from then on, it is the Sabbatians who are the ones who create. First, they create create the Royal Society, and out of the Royal Society comes the Freemasons, and then. Out of the Freemasons, specifically, the Sabbatians are responsible for creating Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And as Tony said, the motto of Scottish Rite Freemasonry is Ordo Ab Cal. And what that means is that you, since the end times describe chaos preceding the advent of the Messiah, then therefore it means that you need to create those, that chaos as the precondition. So whatever it is, whatever miseries are described, pestilence, wars, disease, famine, all those things need to be created so that you can bring about the coming of the Messiah. So here you have a picture. There's many ways in which the expectations of the end times have been created. One of them is Hitler. So Hitler, as you know, is basically, he created what's called the Third Reich. And the Third Reich is found, the idea of the Third Reich is founded on the, yes? Somebody interrupting me? So the Third Reich is creating an idea of going back to Joachim of Fuhrer, a saint from a Dominican mystic from, I believe, 1200s or 1300s, who predicted the coming of the process of the end time happening in three phases. And this was directly appropriated by Muller van der Broek. And I've only got a few minutes, so I'm going to go very quickly. So basically, if we skip forward to our time, and the Book of Revelation, much of what's described in the Book of Revelation is a mirror image of the Semitic expectations that are expected by the Muslims. So what seems to be happening is that there's a deliberate attempt, by pitting the Christian evangelicals against the Muslims. And what's interesting is that Jay Michelson, who's actually his PhD was on Sabbatais V, he wrote an article in the Daily Beast a couple of years ago, and he identified exactly this problem. He says, indeed, as a student of millennialism, for some time, it was shocking to see the congruence between the Islamic State's vision of the end times and that of evangelical Christianity. The large battle somewhere north to the northwest of Jerusalem, a final battle in Jerusalem, with the near defeat of the heroic believers of an Antichrist figure, and then Jesus appearing from heaven to win the battle once and for all. So this seems to be how the evangelicals are being pitted against the Muslims. And of course, the evangelicals, they are Christian Zionists, influenced heavily by the Sabbateans. And their focus, of course, is the rebuilding of the Third Temple, which is supposed to happen Al-Aqsa, which, of course, is going to be, if it goes forward, is going to be a substantial disruption and an affront to the Islamic world, which will likely outbreak in some kind of global conflict. One of the most important exponents of this occult tradition and conspirators involved in this effort is Alexander Dugin. So Alexander Dugin, basically, he is playing the role of advancing the mirror image of the clash of civilizations, which was articulated by the neoconservatives. And the clash of civilizations, again, is basically another formulation of the book of Revelation, a preparation for the end times. So if you understand how Alexander Dugin explains it here, he explains how the bringing about the end times actively is a task. He says the end times and the eschatological meaning of politics will not realize themselves on their own. We will wait for the end times in vain. The end will never come if we wait for it, and it will never come if we do not. This is essential because history, time, and reality have special strategies to avoid Judgment Day, or rather, they have a special strategy for a revelatory maneuver that will create the impression that everyone has come to a realization and an understanding. This is the huge arsenal of Heidegger's Noch Nicht and the Eternal Not Yet. If the fourth political practice is not able to realize the end times, then it will be invalid. The end times should come, but it will not come by itself. This is a task. It is not a certainty. It is active metaphysics. It is a practice. And I'll finish there because that's right on time.
Well, thank you, David.